Information, please, usually presented by the makers of the Parker 51 pen at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Wednesdays, will not be heard tonight. Instead, the Columbia Broadcasting System presents The Eagle's Brood, starring Joseph Cotten with Luther Adler.
It was 2 months ago. It was a sharp New England night. It was the waterfront. It was three husky American youngsters on the prowl, looking for excitement. It was a drunk. They struck him. They knocked him down. They dragged him into an alley. They robbed him. They beat him and left him bleeding and unconscious. Twenty minutes later, they came back. They looked for more money. A siren screamed. They ran, straight into the drawn guns of two officers in a patrol car. The next morning, the drunk, battered, unsteady, all his teeth gone, stood in juvenile court. The judge said, "If you press this charge, it could mean life imprisonment." The man shrugged and said, "I don't care."
I don't care. I don't care. From Akron to Atlanta, Memphis to Milwaukee, Tulsa to Trenton, the citizens of this country are saying, "I don't care. I don't care." And day by day, hour by hour, from Boston to Butte, Hartford to Houston, Savannah to Spokane, more and more children are climbing the crescendo of a wave of crime, brutality, violence, and murder. What does it mean? Is it just another post-war problem that will pass with time? Does it concern your children, healthy, normal youngsters growing up in the typical American way? In the next 60 minutes, you will hear a special CBS documentary unit production based upon a nationwide tour of investigation made recently by Robert Louis Cheyenne. As you listen, you may turn to your husband, your wife, and say with a comforting sigh, "This is not about us. This is about some other people." Every terrifying episode bears a direct, challenging meaning to you and yours. Every shocking revelation is fact. This is what is happening to all of us and to our children today. With Joseph Cotten as star, this is The Eagle's Brood.
I was in a teenage canteen. It was the Negro quarter of an East Coast city. It was Halloween. The canteen was run by a soft drink firm with a conscience. It was red and purple and orange and fluorescent lights. It was hot. Fast, exciting dancing. The youngsters yelled and whirled and jumped. A jukebox blared and a single drummer beat out the lace.
They say this section is the most congested spot in the whole United States. They say if you crowded New York City the way we're crowded, you could fit all the people of America into its five boroughs. I don't know how true that is, but on a night like this, it sure looks like it in here.
She was a recreation worker. She was in charge of the place. She was large and jovial, and she mothered the kids in a roughhouse, friendly fashion.
I run this canteen all by myself. I could use help, lots of it. If I only had a gymnasium, more space, more people interested. These kids are growing up. They're busting with energy. This is the only place where they can dance and fool around without someone saying, "Don't do this, you mustn't do that." That's what gets them to rumbling.
What's rumbling?
Fighting, gang war, the stuff you read about in the papers. There are boys from four gangs in here tonight. They left their bombs and guns and knives outside. But they behave in here. Outside, it's different. This place is their own.
I went outside. The streets were alive with cops and squad cars and rookies. They were touchy on edge. It was Halloween. Anything might happen. A cab driver hurried my change. "This is no place to be," he muttered. "I'm getting out of here." I sat in a bar and talked to Frankie. Frankie was 15. He was the war counselor for King Arthur's Knights. King Arthur's Knights was the name of his gang. Frankie was chief of staff, Generalissimo. He planned the strategy. Frankie had been shot in the shoulder last week. The bullet was still in his flesh. It wasn't the first time.
Yeah, the other time I was shot in the neck. The bullet missed my spine by 1 inch. Everybody thought I was going to die. My mother even went and called the undertaker. But I fooled them. I came back talking and laughing and doing everything.
How did it happen, Frankie?
Well, I'm the war counselor, you see. I got a rant. The darn walls, they come after me. They put a pistol in my belly. They say, "You're a punk." I say, "Don't make no trouble. I'm not looking for trouble." They say, "You King Arthur's knights." Ah, they start shooting. I start running. I didn't know that I was hit. Someone say, "Frankie, your neck is bleeding." That's how I know. So I go to the hospital. I get better. Then we go after them darn ones. This time with artillery.
Where do you get the artillery?
Oh, we make them ourselves. We buy them downtown. Small fry give them to us. Brought them back from the wall.
Small fry?
Yeah, that's how we organize. Tom Thumbs and Tim Thumbs and medium seniors and a small fry. Small fry overs. So we get our artillery and we go after them darn ones.
How many members?
Oh, a couple of hundred. You don't go all in a pack. You travel along the streets by twos and threes, some along the sidewalk. You know, just playing and laughing. Some just walking along and talking. So the cops don't get wise. We get them darn ones and we mess them up good and send maybe 30 of them to the hospital. That's how I got sent to juvenile court. One of them darn ones was on top of me, stomped me in the face, and I stabbed him in the leg. It was the only way I could protect myself.
Why do you rumble, Frankie? How does it all start?
Man, you gotta rumble, otherwise you ain't got no protection. You live on a block, and you go on another block, and another gang will say, "Who are you?" You say, "I'm no club." They say, "Get off the block." They take your clothes, they shoot you, they stab you. You don't grow up that way.
We got up and walked out. A detective rose from the next table and followed us. Two more sat in a gray sedan by the curb with the doors open. They were watching us. Frankie and I went back to the canteen. Frankie got a girl and started dancing. I sipped a soft drink and listened to the recreation workers.
The boys rumble for rep. They're growing up, though. They're finding out that rep has its disadvantages. When something goes wrong, the police pick you up. The other gang's gun for you. These boys want to get married. The girls don't like this gang business. They try to tell them, but those youngsters won't listen. They want rep. And all the time, they're growing up just like any other American youngsters. Full of energy, feeling their muscles, their emotions boiling, wanting normal fun, a place to call their own, getting hemmed in, busting out, the rumblings, the stabbings, the shootings, the blowing over the walls into the white neighborhood.
I tell you, mister, people are getting crazier every day. Women, too. Young ones from good families, plenty of money. They're doing the wackiest things, blowing their top, going off their nuts.
I was in a city in the middle Atlantic state. I was in a cab. My plane had just landed. The driver was taking me from the airport to the hotel.
That 20-year-old in the papers, the one that beat her 3-year-old son, hit him over the head with a piece of box crepe with big nails on it, then burned him with a red-hot iron, took his pants off. Red-hot iron, imagine.
Pass the paper back to me. That it was in the headline. Young mother beat 3-year-old son. A picture of the girl being taken to jail. A picture of the boy, his eyes swollen, his mouth torn. A close-up where the hot surface of the iron had seared into his skin.
That mother ought to get what's coming to her. They ought to send her to jail for life. They ought to lock her up and punish her good. She's nuts, that's what she is. I got a kid of my own. He's 4. If my wife ever did that to him, I'd kill her.
I checked in at my hotel and bought the latest edition. The headlines were bigger. There were more pictures. The husband. The girl's wealthy parents. The kid in the hospital receiving baskets of fruits and flowers. The neighbors testifying that they had heard the child screaming before. I went to an official. I asked if I could see the mother.
Why, sure, this afternoon, after the grand jury gets through with her. We're going to get an indictment. We're going to put her behind bars for 6 years, at least.
What's she like?
She's vicious. Poison. The quicker we put her away, the better. The public is clamoring for action. We'll run her through in record time.
In the afternoon, I saw the mother. She was white-faced, desperate, at the breaking point.
Yes, I've beaten him before. I'll beat him again. He's obstinate, stubborn, and he loathes me. And I hate him. I hate him.
Is this your first marriage?
No. No, my first husband was a bomber pilot. We knew each other a month. We eloped. He was killed overseas.
When did you marry again?
I married John 2 years ago. He was hurt badly in the war. His first wife left him. He's always drinking, always talking about her.
Why did you marry him?
Did you ever hate your mother and father? Did you ever want to humiliate them? Did you ever live in a home that was a prison? Have every decision made for you? Never go out, never do this, never do that? Be respectable. Remember who you are. Did you ever do something wrong and have it drummed into your head 1,000 times a day that you were no good, a disgrace to your family, and that you'd wind up in jail? Well, I'm here. And I'm very glad. I hope my dad and mother are getting their pictures plastered all over the front pages. I hope everybody in this town is talking about them. My respectable father and mother.
I went back to the official. Why don't the papers print a little of that girl's background? Why don't they try to give the public some understanding of why she behaved the way she did?
The public doesn't want understanding. It wants sensationalism. A good story.
Who says so?
Editors all over the country. Go and ask them. They'll tell you what sells papers.
But there must be thousands of well-meaning fathers and mothers who are making the same mistake that this girl's parents made. Youngsters are committing crimes who have every material advantage except understanding.
So what? Everybody gets beat up these days just by conditions. People need someone to take it out on. That's what the papers are for. They give the public a whipping boy or girl. What's the difference? A good witch hunt now and then is like a bloodletting. It sells papers that lets off steam. If you ask me, it's a good deal. We need one now and then just to keep on living in this cockeyed world. The public likes it that way. And if they don't, why don't they change it?
I was on a train heading west. I'd been to the deep south. I lay in my berth and watched the darkness go by. I thought of Henderson on the prison farm. I thought of the teacher and the four boys, the sheriff and the judge. I thought of Mason. Mason had cared. He had yelled. He had tried to do things.
Juvenile delinquency? Brother, you've come to the right town. I know. I was born here.
Mason was young, clean-cut. He'd been in the Navy. Wore a smart gray tweed suit. He was the college instructor type. Soft-spoken, direct, honest. He was a reporter.
Go down to Shantytown. Take a look at the shacks owned by wealthy, respectable citizens. They rent them for $2-3 a week. Whole families live in them in one room with chickens and dogs and no plumbing. They're building a housing project on the edge of a garbage dump. Flies get in the milk. The smoke of the burning garbage gets into the school windows. The kids scavenge for half-open boxes of raisins. Our city offers itself to tourists. But what has it got to offer its own people? The average citizen doesn't care. He isn't interested.
What about the juvenile court?
The judge is a politician. He's running for re-election. He's got no background, no training, but he's the machine candidate, so he'll probably get in again. He's been on the bench for years. He plays God with children's lives for votes. Come election time, there are judges that send out word to the cops not to make any juvenile arrests. It's bad for the record. That's the lowdown. You can have it. I'm through with the newspaper racket. What's the good of yelling? Nobody listens. I'm getting me a job as a publicity director for a cotton firm. Fight for civic change? Don't make me laugh.
The hotel room we had talked in was on the second floor. It looked over the main street. White banners with red feathers swung in the breeze outside, lighted up by rows of electric bulbs. It was community chess campaign time. The posters in the smart shop windows showed a blonde kid in a torn sweater with an underprivileged look rising out of a big fist. Slogan read, "He's in your hands." Next morning, I went to a juvenile court. It was in a police station. Drunks, petty gamblers, and other offenders mingled with mothers carrying babies in their arms. A court attendant barked names in an icy, impersonal tone. And tight-lipped family groups got up out of hard wooden seats and passed in and out of the judge's chambers. The air inside crackled with long-standing feud, personal recrimination, private needling. The sheriff brought in a girl.
Pilfering, Your Honor. 4 rings from Hyde's department store. Value, 75 cents.
Girl wore red combs in her kinky black hair. Her fingernails were painted white. She was 13.
This girl has been in this court 22 times, Your Honor. She has no parents, no known address.
I remember. Send her to the shelter. The
shelter won't have her. Last time she was there, she damaged property.
Let her aunt take her.
Her aunt has had her twice, Your Honor.
Then give her to the preacher.
The preacher says she's ungovernable and uncontrollable.
The girl is paroled in her own custody.
I looked at the judge in amazement. Your Honor, isn't there some place this girl can be sent to so she won't get into any more trouble?
If she were 14, I'd throw her in the county jail for 90 days and put the fear of God in her.
But don't you have a home for wayward girls in this state?
Not for her kind.
On the wall was a quotation. The juvenile court should be a place where the community first discovers the child in trouble. It should determine the pressures which are causing the trouble. Then the court should seek to remove these pressures in a friendly, understanding spirit. All morning, the cases paraded in and out of the judge's chambers. Nearly all were what they call recidivists. That meant they had been in before. Little was done to check their home conditions, nothing to correct them. They just came and went from the streets to the court, from the courts to the streets. And all the time, they were growing up, older and tougher.
It's an endless procession. 18 years ago, in this very room, I taught the fathers of three boys who are here today.
I was in a home for delinquent boys on the outskirts of town. I was talking to a teacher. He was a big man with a deep baritone voice. The diction of an orator and straight, boring eyes.
These boys grow up and have children of their own. After a while, many of them desert their families. The father isn't legally liable for support. The mother does the best she can. The children shift for themselves.
Pointed to a tall, awkward boy sitting on a workbench.
That boy has six brothers, each by a different father. He's 15. At 7, he was first committed for loitering. At 8, he returned here voluntarily, because he had no place else to sleep. At 9, petty larceny. At 10, breaking and entering in the daytime. At 12, he came back again. Car theft. At 14, material witness. Now he's in for grand larceny.
And after that?
There are not many possibilities. If you're interested in one, I suggest you go down to the county jail. Ask them to show you the boys in the cell block on the top floor.
There were four of them. One 16, two 17, and the fourth 19. A deputy quietly explained that it was all right to answer my questions if they cared to. Haltingly, they looked through the bars and sketched their stories.
I don't know who my parents were. I ran away from my uncle when I was in the fourth grade.
Yes, sir.
I was arrested before.
I was out at the home for boys. I don't remember how many times, maybe 7 or 8.
One boy had been baptized that morning. He wore a cross on a chain around his neck. Another said he was getting comfort from the Bible. The third just sat on the edge of his cot. The fourth was reading a comic magazine. They were waiting to be executed. The deputy took me into the adjoining room.
Now, this is where we're going to execute him. Over there is where the witnesses will sit. You know, reporters and that sort of stuff. And over here is where the chair will be. We used to hang them. The noose come down here, and the ropes are tied to the bars on this window here. Then we cut this trap in the floor here, and we dropped them below. And they carried the bodies away. That kind of made it neater. But now we got the most modern improvement. Now we're going to have a portable electric chair. It travels all around the state. Now let me show you. It'll sit right here where the trap is, and the wires will lead over to the window, same as the ropes did. The witnesses will sit in the same place. No need to disturb them. And if you look at the trimming on the walls, you'll see that it's plaster instead of wood. We had wood, but we changed it a few weeks ago. We're improving all the time. Oh, yeah, the prisoners do that. We got some mighty fine workmen locked up in here. Painters and plasterers and carpenters and... You'd be surprised.
My stomach felt like a hollow cave. Here was this man, droning on at our trap doors and ropes coming down and wires. The four kids were going to die. They were going to die because this public officials and the citizens behind him didn't know or didn't care about where they were born, how they lived, or what they did. It didn't matter that this was America. It didn't matter that this was the 20th century. It didn't matter that they hadn't even begun to live. It didn't matter that... that nothing would be gained when they died. It didn't matter. Nothing. Nothing mattered except this man's blind, stupid, blasphemous, incredible pride in his plaster paint and portable electric chair and modern improvements.
Show him how the doors open individual. That's it. Every single prisoner can go in and out of his cell all by himself.
I remembered the prison siren at the State Farm. Henderson had turned to me and said,
"You hear that? That's an escape. One of the prisoners has broken out. He's taken to the hills."
Henderson was a trustee. He was driving me around the prison farm.
22,000 acres of the most fertile land this side of the Nile. That's what the book says, you know, in the warden's office. It's so amusing, I memorized it. Here, the law's offenders may repay their debt to society while they rebuild depleted minds and bodies through invigorating work in the fields and the various industries which thus provide the state the double profit of revenue from farm produce as well as rehabilitation. Great, huh?
Henderson was a college graduate. Henderson was right. The prison was a plantation. It was fields and fields of sugarcane and sweet potatoes and carrots and beets and onions. It was narrow dirt roads with ruts. It was lone sentinels in the small shelters atop of tall posts. It was unspeakably filthy camps and dungeons, barbed wire barricades for whites, for Negroes, for women. It was one word, medieval. It was convicted murderers with rifles in their hands. They were trustees.
Warden gives them the guns and makes them guards over the other prisoners.
Why?
Well, it's impossible to get enough free guards to come out here. Not enough pay. No decent place to live, bring up family. Well, we're miles from the nearest town, you know. Nothing but wilderness and hills. That's why the convict who just escaped won't get away. Bloodhounds will be after him in a little while. He may get shot by one of them guards. Killed.
We passed a gang of men working in the fields. They were bare except for dungarees and shoes. They wore wide straw hats. They were watched by a guard. He had a rifle in one hand and a whip in the other.
Yeah, and he uses both, too. A new prisoner checks in. He's not used to rough life. He's put to work 12 hours a day in the hot sun. He can't take it. He falls down. The guard thinks he's gold-breaking. He whips him. And if the con makes a break, the guard shoots. Those guards are in for life, you know. What do they care?
I asked Henderson what he was in for.
Fraud.
How in the world did a man like you ever get into a place like this?
Well, it was during the boom. Things were riding high, lush. See, I was a contractor doing business with the state. I doctored up an invoice here, another one there. Nothing very much. Everybody was getting theirs. I just got caught, that's all. Hey, you hear the bloodhounds? They're getting started. I wonder who it is. I wonder if that youngster who just come in.
Youngster in here?
Certainly. From 16 on, they're adults in this state. We got hundreds of them, 21 and under. They get shoved up with the other cons. Same treatment, same everything. Just like the youngster I'm thinking about now, the fresh fish.
How old?
19. Good-looking boy. Father's a bank official.
How do you know?
I check the records when they come into the warden's office. I saw the kid's case history. Makes very interesting reading. His dad owns a sailboat, and yet the kid's in for stealing cars. Judge said to him, "All my life I dreamed of owning a sailboat. Your father has one, yet you go around stealing cars. Why?" Kid didn't say, but the probation officer knew. His dad was too busy making money down at the bank to spend any time with him. So now he's in here for 2 years with murderers, thieves, dope addicts, perverts. I hate to think what's ahead for him. That's pretty rotten, isn't it? Don't bother me much, though. The day I drive through those gates, I am forgetting there is such a place. What I care.
I studied Henderson.
I wondered if back in his life there was a broken home, overprotective parents like those the girl had who beat her son, or a too busy father. Where was the danger signal? What was the thing, the mysterious thing that had brought this man to an American Devil's Island? Mason and the judge, the deputy sheriff, and the teacher and the kids, Henderson and the bloodhounds and the fresh fish whose father was a bank official. This is true. This is true, I kept reminding myself on the train heading west. This is actually happening in America today. The deep south faded with a deep dark.
Sometimes you get the wrong address, so the family has moved. You never know what you're going to find.
It was a city on the West Coast. Her name was Mrs. Grover. She was an attendance worker. They used to call them truant officers. We stood before the door of an apartment in a public housing project. It was up on a hill near the bay. There were slaughterhouses and shipyards. There were smells. The units were rectangular, squat, jerry-built. The walls were dull brown. They were scrawled on with chalk and pencil, the things kids write on walls.
The boy who lives here is a chronic runaway. 75 times. Hasn't been at school for the last 3 days.
The door opened. We went in. There were four small rooms, linoleum on the floor with thin red rings. Two youngsters played underfoot. One was 18 months, the other was 2.5. There were no formulas, no sterilized bottles, just empty condensed milk cans, at least 50 of them. The radio was on. The stereo unfolded its daily plot. There were no curtains in the windows. The bed had no sheets. It was bare. It was dingy. It was dirty. The mother was pale and worn. Her hair was uncombed. Her eyes were red and her voice was husky.
Oh.
She was old before her time.
Harry didn't say he was skipping. He must be off with those Mexican kids he hangs around with to a picture show. He sleeps there sometimes all night under the seats. Oh, we ride the streetcars.
Well, where did he get the money?
I give him his milk money in advance. I don't know what to do with him. He's not a bad kid. He's had something wrong with his eyes. He can't talk right. The other kids laugh at him.
Well, the record shows he was doing very well at his last school.
I know. It's a shame. He had a woman teacher there who knew about him. She took an interest. She gave him special jobs. Right after he stopped playing hooky. We had to move, and Harry had to transfer to the school near here. He doesn't like the teachers. Kids around here are tough. Gets into fights. I'm sure things would have been all right if only we hadn't been forced to move.
Well, what was the reason for your moving?
The relief worker made me. They said I had to get along on less, that I was paying too much rent. They said it was cheaper here.
We left the apartment. We got into the attendance worker's car and drove on to her next case. She had 30 stops to make.
I'm glad you saw that, Holmes. That's a perfect example of how we're trying to plug up the holes while the water keeps flowing over the dike.
What do you mean?
Well, there's a new youth authority in this state, probably the finest in the country. The legislature has spared no expense. We've got good judges. We're attracting college graduates as parole officers, probationers, and police. We've got forestry camps, ranch camps. We're making a really enlightened effort to do something to the minds and the hearts of the youngsters who get into trouble instead of just punishing them. But all the time, we keep churning out kids like Harry.
How old is Harry?
11. The boy's father was a shipyard worker. He deserted his family, and the mother went on relief. The child needs love. He needs attention. That poor, tired woman can't give it to him. He probably hates that drab, deadly home. He hates school. Our schools here aren't equipped to meet the special needs of such children.
Why not?
Oh, budgets. No funds. Overcrowding. Our schools are built for the average. But the child who's a little dumb or too smart is just out of luck. I'd be willing to bet that Harry can't read, and yet he's in the seventh grade. Can't keep up with the other children, so he plays truant. He gets into trouble. He's known to the police, the juvenile court. He's been pawed over by service agencies and psychiatrists. He gets one small break, one ray of hope. A teacher who cares, who's interested in what happens. Some relief official makes the family move.
I went to see the official. I asked him what the difference was between the rent Harry's mother was paying now and the rent she had paid before.
$5 a month.
Don't you think it might be cheaper for the community to spend that extra $5 now to give Harry a chance than to spend thousands of dollars later shoving him through the dreary mill of our correctional system?
Now, look, mister, I'm a public servant. My job is to keep costs down. The rule says a family on relief must live at the cheapest rent in keeping with reasonable living conditions. That's what that housing project is. What can I do? The taxpayers pay me to save them every cent I can.
I stood at the foot of the hill. I watched the launch. It pulled out into the bay. It was the warden's launch. It had just brought me back from the rock. The rock is 10 minutes out of the slip at the foot of the hill. The rock is the last stop in the federal prison system. The sun was noon high. Seagulls followed the launch. They settled on the water, perched on the piles. The bridge glinted pink. Great spans were like delicate threads hung on matchsticks. I watched the launch and thought about the assistant warden. He was a kindly man with broad shoulders. He'd worked in prisons, federal prisons, all his life. He'd shown me through the institution. It was Saturday morning. The industries were closed. Most of the cells were empty. The men played baseball in the yard. Upstairs, a prisoner sat by a record machine and fed music through the loudspeakers. I picked up a record. A Little on the Lonely Side. I turned it over. A Talk with the Lord.
You'll notice our library. It's a very fine one. Men read a great deal. Textbooks, biography, philosophy, law.
Law?
Yes, they look for loopholes in the cases to get new trials.
Most of the men are here for life, aren't they?
Oh, no. I think the longest we've had a man's about 10 years.
How's that?
Well, the rock is a threat to all federal prisons all over the United States. If they don't behave at other prisons, they're sent here. When they've made a good record, they're sent back.
But this is the cleanest, best-run penitentiary I've seen. Why don't they want to stay?
Maximum security and minimum privileges. We have about 300 prisoners, 200 guards, ratio 3-2. Most prisons run around 4, 5-1. It's the strict discipline they don't like. Constant scrutiny.
We stopped before one cell. There was no name on the bars, no number.
The boy in that cell left here a few days ago.
Tell me about him.
Well, he was 20. Robbed a bank in the Midwest. Sent 11 with 15 years. Got in a fight, stabbed a guard, 30 more years. Transferred to the rock. I happened to be at Leavenworth shortly before he left. I knew he was coming here, so I said I'll be seeing you. When the boy arrived, I was down at the dock. I said, son, behave yourself while you're here. If you don't, I'll put you across my knee and whale you. Keep on the beam. He did. He was a good boy, had two brothers in the service, one wounded, one killed at Okinawa. I kept after him, kept my eye on him. The officer he stabbed down at Leavenworth came up for a visit. They shook hands. The boy made a good record. He was transferred to Atlanta. His father had died when he was 6. Stepfather was rough on him. I got this letter from him yesterday.
He took an envelope out of his pocket and showed me a few lines.
I don't know how to say it. I don't know how to thank you. But if I'd have had a dad like you, I'd never be where I am now.
You had a rather spectacular break here some time ago.
Yes, it was unsuccessful. There were deaths, of course, guards as well as prisoners. Would you like to see one of the ringleaders?
We stepped over to a small room. Through the bars, I could see attorneys who had come over on the launch with me.
You were talking to several prisoners. One was a stocky, supple, dark lad.
That's Kenty. He's 19, Indian boy from New Mexico.
I stared at the boy. He spoke quietly, thoughtfully. He didn't look the desperate killer who had rocked the rock with national headlines. I would have liked to talk with him, but he was busy, fighting for life. What can you tell me about his background?
Oh, I'll let you look at his record.
I went through the pages. Why should this boy be an exception? The pattern was unmistakable. Born on a reservation, minority group, cultural conflict, broken home, staying out late at night, truancy, juvenile court for stealing. Everybody steals, he told the judge. Robbery, reformatory. It was a hellhole, he said. He was bitter about the treatment. He murdered a guard, escaped. Cruel, aggressive, criminal activities, apprehended, incarcerated. Resents work and regulations. Not intelligent enough for vocational training. Will remain a desperate man for years. Probably will not adjust. Adjust. Even on the Rock, he had tried to break out and killed.
Yes, the men on the Rock are the final desperate failures of our system. Why, we spend between $10 and $18 billion a year in catching our criminals, trying, convicting, punishing them. It doesn't make sense. If we spent only a fraction of that on prevention.
Why don't we?
Oh, it beats me. The experts blame the lawmakers. The lawmakers blame the taxpayers.
And the taxpayers? I stood at the foot of the hill. Behind me, the cable cars clattered up the wide roller coaster streets to the city skyline, looking out on the Pacific. On the grass around me, taxpayers sunbathed, families picnic, kids swam, listened to the World Series. There was a canoe. A father shared a hamburger with his son. In the bay, the Rock was 10 minutes off. On the mainland, where I stood, was an island of indifference.
All set?
All set.
Okay, here we go.
Here's the pilot. She raced the single engine down the cow pasture runway, held its nose with a steady hand, and lifted it smoothly into the air. The wheels went up, and the sun no longer cut their shadow on the ground as we banked and began the slow, circling climb for altitude. Around us, the snow-capped peaks towered 14,000 feet in the blue, bright weather, the peaks we had to top. Below, the superintendent stood in the field by his car and waved goodbye. The valley was warm and pleasant. It was Shangri-La. It was 100 miles away from the nearest city. It was a perfect spot for a mountain state reformatory. They had told me to drive across the range was tough, so I chartered a plane to go above. The pilot was a former WASP. She was a pretty girl.
I've flown over that valley hundreds of times, but I never knew what was down there.
She knew now. The superintendent had taken her through with me. I wondered what she was thinking about now. I wondered if she was thinking about the empty classrooms and what the superintendent had said.
Where are the boys and the teachers?
We don't have any teachers.
Why not?
We can't get any to come out here at $140 a month.
Then what do the boys do?
Work in the fields, shops. We try to give them some vocational training, but it's practically impossible to get teachers with shop experience who are also good counselors. This reformatory was built in 1895. Today was the first time we've ever had a psychiatrist in here.
The buildings were prison-style, cell blocks, three-tier. The dormitories, dining room, corridors were bare, run-down, drab. It smelled of disinfectant like all the others I'd smelled. There were pictures cut out of magazines. Photos by the beds. The girl back home, the mother, the gang. They bit through the bleakness for a touch of warmth, of home. There was a boy of 12 in solitary. He was blind. His feet were bare. It
tugged at his belt and towed the cold floor.
Why are you here, Jimmy?
Ran away. Yesterday was visiting day. Wanted to see my mother. She didn't come.
We walked away. The boy's parents are divorced. His mother's remarried. The new husband doesn't want Jimmy. The mother struggles between her new life and her love for her son. And looks like the new life is winning. Jimmy took off to the next state to find his father. The sheriff picked him up, kept him in the local jail for a week before he let us know he had him. The boy was beaten by the kangaroo court.
The kangaroo court? What's that?
A rotten practice. Goes on almost everywhere. Jailers allow the strongest, toughest prisoners to run the prisons. When a new prisoner comes in, they try him in a mock court. They rob him, beat him, make him do the menial jobs. Sometimes they torture, murder him.
And the jailers permit it?
Sure, it's easier to run the jail that way. Saves money, too. Many sheriffs are allowed to charge a fee for every prisoner. The less the sheriff spends on food and guards, or money he makes.
How about the legislature? Doesn't it ever do anything about conditions?
Oh, yes. Every time a boy dies in one of the state schools from a beating at the hands of a brutal guard, the papers make an uproar. A committee comes down here, just as you have. They shake their heads and say what you say. They go back. And that's the last we ever hear of it. Until the next time.
But why? Why?
There are no votes in these kids. We make them, we teach them, we graduate them, we even give them degrees. Masters of crime. In the College of Revenge.
If you could say one thing about this to the American people, what would it be?
Tell them to come and see. That's all. Come and see.
The long, slow, circling climb was over. The pilot had leveled off. The plane arrowed eastward over the stubby, bearded mountains powdered with snow. I sat strapped to my seat. The sun warmed the glass bubble over the cockpit. I looked out on earth and sky. I thought about my trip. I tried to capture the meaning of all I had seen. Juvenile delinquents come from slums and minority groups. But they also come from wealthy homes and middle-class families. Juvenile delinquents are not born bad. Nobody is born bad. The odds against them are just higher than average, that's all. The odds are ignorant, careless, or incapable parents, rich or poor. The odds are physical and mental handicaps, high-tension neighborhoods, overcrowded, under-equipped schools. The odds are lack of jobs and meaningful activity while the sap of youth runs hot in their growing bodies. The odds are the values by which we live, making them want more and more all the time, success, luxury, emotional adventure. The odds are outdated juvenile courts, jails, and reform schools that still seek to separate, to punish, instead of to understand and to help. The odds are indifferent citizens, too busy making a living themselves, to know or care or lend a hand to the valiant, lonely fighters in every state who are trying to do something. Take any combination of such odds, and you'll see how tough it is for even a normal kid to win, let alone the ones who are forced, by no choice of their own, to play the game the hard way. Well, what do we do about it? What can we do? Pay for better juvenile courts? Get more parole officers? Wipe out the evils of our courts and jails and reform schools? Fair enough. But for every youngster we'll set straight, 100 others will come off the assembly line. It's like an epidemic. In the old days, when malaria struck, the doctors isolated the victims. Then they tried treating the patient. Finally, they cleaned out the swamps. That ended malaria epidemics. Well,
juvenile delinquency is also an epidemic. We won't ever stop it by isolation, by individual treatment. We've got to clean out the swamps that breed it. The homes, the schools, the stagnant pools of ignorance, indifference, injustice. But that's an impossible job. To get better homes, we need better parents. To get better parents, we need better teachers. To get better teachers, we need better schools. To get better schools, we need better citizens. To get better citizens, we need better homes. It's a merry-go-round. Where do we get off? The plane crossed the mountains and nosed down to a perfect landing. I left the airfield and boarded a train for a city in the Midwest. There, in a slum, in a stockyard neighborhood that had fed more juvenile delinquents to the prisons of our nation than any other, I met a man who answered my question. He was young, but there was gray around his temples. He'd been a welfare worker, a criminologist. He'd studied gangs, worked in prisons, written books. He was a man with a vision. The director of an organization helping to start neighborhood councils all over America. He spoke with drive, enthusiasm.
Neighborhood council. That's one place we can get off the merry-go-round.
What's a neighborhood council?
Grassroots democracy. The town meeting kind. The kind that founded our country. The kind the people in this neighborhood have started. The kind that people are starting in other cities. A neighborhood council is all the organizations in any neighborhood getting together and saying, this is ours. This is where we live. If there's going to be change, improvement for our children, for us, we're going to do it. With our own hands, brains, money, and imagination. Not you. Not they. Not anybody but us.
How?
Come on. I'll show you.
He took me through the neighborhood. It was a mile and a half square. It was 200,000 people. It was rattling, antiquated trolleys. It was shacks. It was alleys. It was washout of windows. It was walls and roofs starving for paint, fences and porches, hungry for a hammer. It was blight. It was cheap. It was 5 and 10 stencil of every slum in every city in the world, American style. But the people, they were different.
Well, I'm a businessman. This is my store. I've been in this neighborhood 34 years. Well, I remember when there was shoplifting and window smashing and gang killing. Not anymore. No, sir. Not since the neighborhood council.
I am un Mexicano. It used to be a favorite sport in this neighborhood to beat up the Mexicanos. The Lithuanians hitting the Poles, the Slovaks hitting the Jews, and the Irish hitting everybody. The Negroes, they just could not walk the streets. But not anymore. The neighborhood council is teaching understanding, friendship.
I'm a union organizer. 95% of the people in this neighborhood work in the packing houses. Even after we'd organized, some of the packers wouldn't negotiate. Other people tried to set the churches against us. But the churches belonged to the council. They stood behind us in a block. Priests took to the radio, to the picket line, to the street corner. People got angry. The bishop was threatened. I was shot. But the neighborhood was behind us. We won a contract. Nobody in the union can say enough about the council.
I'm a teacher back at the yard. Our children used to suffer from rickets. They needed orange juice. So we preached orange juice in school, in church, at clubs, at union meetings, and in our neighborhood journal. Wherever the people went, they heard about orange juice. They got orange juice. We gave the children a questionnaire. We asked them, are there rats in your house? Does the roof leak? Are there broken steps? We found 3,600 violations. We sent them to the city authorities. They ignored us. We printed the findings in our paper. We got action.
I'm the district police captain. We don't consider delinquency by itself, but as part of the whole picture. If a boy gets into trouble, we don't take him to court. We take him to a committee of the neighborhood council. We find out why. If he needs money to buy decent clothing, we get him a job. We organized the gangs into athletic clubs. We gave them responsible positions in the council. We don't make any claims about delinquency rates. Ask the people who live here.
I'm a veteran.
When I came back after 5 years overseas, the neighborhood council got me a job. I couldn't believe my eyes. My dad wasn't griping about foreigners fighting him for his job. My sister's baby wasn't playing in the streets while she worked. The baby was in a day nursery. My kid brother belongs to my old gang. But now they don't carry knives. They're throwing footballs around in the big playground that used to be an empty lot. I used to worry about being ashamed to come back here. Ashamed, mister? I'm proud to live in this neighborhood.
What's the catch, I said to the man with a vision. There must be a catch.
There isn't any. There are weaknesses, yes. Not all the people take part. A few lead, the rest follow. Some come in to get. They stay to give.
Isn't the council a pressure group?
Right. A group of people democratically fighting the pressures under which they live. Why, what's the matter? What's wrong with that?
I don't know. I haven't thought it out. This is new. This is different.
This is the most exciting thing that's happening in America today. Only it won't amount to much with just a council here and a council there. Too many problems in any community just can't be tackled on a local scale. Understand? That's why we've got to have neighborhood councils everywhere in America. In rich communities as well as slums, farms as well as cities. Pooling their efforts, working toward common objectives. Making their voices heard in every government office from town hall to the White House and Capitol Hill.
How do you start? What do you do?
We start by getting rid of the idea that people don't care. They do care. But their caring is buried so deep they've forgotten about it. They don't know about anybody else caring. They don't think they can do anything about it.
Well, can they?
As individuals, no. But as an organized community, they're dynamite.
How do you arouse people? How do you alert them?
You get to know your neighbors. Give them a chance to know you. You act like a human being. How can we expect our kids to behave like human beings if we don't? Have you ever spoken to your neighbor? Smiled at a stranger? Well, try it. See what it does. You find out who the leaders are in your neighborhood. Not the stuffed shirts, the professional passers of resolutions, the do-gooders who break their necks with their tongues, but the real leaders, the natural leaders. Every community has them, you know. They may be the best gin rummy player, the man who knows the baseball averages, the town grocer, and you talk to them about kids. Now, everyone will argue about everything in this country except about kids. About kids, everybody agrees. Kids are swell.
All right. They agree. Then what?
Well, you take time off from a movie. You call a meeting. You invite the representatives of the clubs in your neighborhood, the churches, the unions, the business groups. They've all got a reason for being in the community, or they wouldn't be there. You fan each other's interest.
Then what? Isn't it still just talk?
No. These leaders are a surprise bunch of citizens. This is the first time anyone has ever called them leaders. They're not the talking kind. They're the real roots of the community. And they get moving.
But how? What kind of an organization? Do you elect officers, have funds?
No, look, forget about blueprints. Organization will come from the people themselves. What are you, a local committee, a neighborhood group? Okay, that's what you call yourself. You know, there are plenty of big-name organizations with nothing behind them but a name. They don't even pack the weight of their own letterhead. What does a name matter? Offices? You elect them. Funds? Well, what do you need funds for? Salaries? Now, this is from the heart. Nobody gets paid. Out goes salaries. Rent? Well, you're meeting at the Aldridge's. The Websters say, next meeting's in ours. Literature? Announcements? Someone says, I'll get Harold to do the printing. Harold's crazy about kids.
Sooner or later, don't you have to have a permanent place, a full-time worker?
When the right time comes, you hire a man, someone who's grown up in the community. Chances are he's already proved he's the man for the job by doing the most work, giving most of his time. You need money for his salary, his office, telephone? You get all you want. It's good business. Whatever is good for the community is good for you. If you cut down delinquency, you cut down thefts, taxes, insurance.
Do you make enemies? You run into trouble?
Plenty. The first thing you learn is that there's no such thing as a nonpartisan organization. The only nonpartisans wear tombstones for hats. But everybody is partisan about kids. That's the glue, the cement that holds you together.
How about friends?
You'll be surprised. The ones you least expect. The cop on the beat. The frozen puss bank. The local ward healer.
Politicians?
Sure. Why not? Some of them. They came up from the people. They're among them. They're realistic. They know the meaning of votes. They've got hearts. Give them a chance. Let them know they've got everybody's support. Watch them.
Do the people stick? Does the fire cool off?
I'll tell you, some get suspicious. They say, well, Sam's got an angle. He's got a new car. Must be making a little on the side. What's he trying to do, run for office? But you keep on. You stand by your acts. You get to be a big shot because of your bank account. No, not because of your bank account. Not by outsmarting the other fellow either. But by being a big human being.
Aren't there dangers in too much community pride?
Right. There's a word for it. Community chauvinism. Look out for it. You've learned that delinquency is related to other things. You've learned that if you live on 16th Street and you don't want your kid to go wrong, you watch the kid on 15th Street and the one on 14th and so on. Now learn that if you live in Brooklyn, you keep your eyes on Texas. And Texas keeps its eyes on Minnesota, and Minnesota on Los Angeles and Boston. A windy world, my friend. Huh? Now, one small spark won't survive. You've got to have lots of little fires reaching out across the mountains and plains and rivers to make one big fire. The fire of an aroused democratic citizenship, sharing in their government. Then you'll reap the whole reward for, although you will have started with just a simple citizen's impulse to help other people's kids, you'll find that you're opening a door to a fuller life for your own kids. Our children are people. Our children are our only real asset. Our future is the eagle's brood.
Columbia and its affiliated stations have just presented The Eagle's Brood, starring Joseph Cotton as the narrator, with Luther Adler as the Neighborhood Council Director. The Eagle's Brood was a CBS documentary unit production written and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne. The musical score was composed and conducted by Alexander Semler. Information, please, presented by the makers of Parker 51 Pen, which was not broadcast tonight so that you might hear The Eagle's Brood, will be heard at the regular scheduled time next Wednesday evening when the guests will be Oscar Levant and Charles G. Boulder. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.